Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
We all know that healthcare delivery systems are wildly complex. Solving problems and promoting efficiency requires expertise. One approach to helping healthcare systems function better is system thinking. We are going to learn more about this strategy next on Sound Practice. My guest today is David Machar. David Machar is professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine. Dr. Machar is also professor in program in health services and systems research at Duke NUS Medical School in Singapore. David Machar, welcome to Sound Practice.
Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, sir. Before we get into the subject matter, I'm interested if you could provide us with an overview of your career path as a physician leader.
Well, I started at Duke in 1980. After medical school, I did my fellowship. I did my residency, and then I did my fellowship at Duke. And it was in research. But I had been taking advantage during my research career in my background in statistics and decision sciences. So that was what I did when I was an undergraduate at Princeton. But then when I went to medical school, I went straight through medical school. I just did medicine. I did everything they told me to do. I was a really good resident, I think. And I practiced at least part-time ever since until the last couple of years. So really my perspective is both from the direction of, you know, how does one use technical analysis to promote better healthcare services from a primary care perspective, which is really what my background is, to how do you actually do this in practice? So that's really my career trajectory. I could give you lots of different paths along the way. I was director of the Duke Center for Clinical Health Policy Research, and we did a lot of work with Medicare. And I'm now currently also working in Singapore with a government entity that is involved in incorporating genetic testing into the clinical environment. So that's just examples of some of the things that I've been doing that kind of bring together those two different sides of me, which is both the clinical background and the technical background.
We're going to be talking about systems thinking. And for those of us that are unfamiliar with the term, could you give me a 30,000 foot view of systems thinking, maybe a working definition, some examples?
Well, systems thinking is often described, and I mentioned this to you when you and I had an exchange earlier, is often expressed as a sentiment, which is to say that, you know, that everything is interrelated. So when we work in a healthcare environment, you can't really just think about your own silo. You have to think about how your silo is related to other silos. So systems thinking is, you know, for want of a better word, it's holistic. And it focuses on what are the components of the system and how do those components interact with each other, and sometimes in positive and sometimes in negative ways, and where can you identify leverage points in that broader system, that more endogenous system that we're thinking about, that would allow you to stabilize the whole system rather than simply focusing on addressing the problem of, say, the emergency room or the primary care clinic.
Thank you. Systems thinking applied to, as you were stating, clinical and public health policy seems, I think everyone would agree, like a great idea. But as your work points out, it's often treated as a general sentiment rather than a practically useful approach to improving the performance of healthcare organizations. What's a useful way to think about systems thinking that is more than just aspirational?
Well, first of all, it's aspirational because it makes sense. I mean, people think about it and they say, wow, you know, my emergency room is crowded, So I know that some of the problem that I'm experiencing in my emergency room is related to what's going on in primary care in the community. But that's the sentiment. The actual implementation of systems thinking would require using specific techniques or approaches to deconstructing those interrelated systems and going through that process I mentioned earlier, which is understanding where your leverage points might be so that the whole system, not just your emergency room, is functioning in a stable and humane way. So, I mean, I guess I'm not giving you an entire answer because part of it has to do with developing the skill set. It's kind of like some decades ago, it was very popular to talk about, and it still is, to talk about total quality, quality management and quality improvement, and focusing on, you know, reducing the number of steps in a process and that sort of stuff. And you could actually go to courses to learn about how to do total quality management. This is similar. The problem, and I will acknowledge that it's a problem or it's a challenge. Let me put it, you put it in more positive terms. It's a challenge, is that doing systems thinking in a very coherent way requires a higher skill set than simply doing total quality management. Total quality management is something you can learn by going for a 2 or 3 day course. Systems thinking and really application of systems thinking either requires a longer trajectory of education or the engagement of skilled practitioners who are prepared to work with you and take the time that it takes to deconstruct your system or systems. And it requires individuals in the system who are willing to put the time in to actually work with that facilitator.
It strikes me that traditionally medicine has been a combination of art and science. Does systems thinking delete the art component of the equation?
No, it doesn't. I mean, systems thinking is actually, interestingly enough, I mean, in the area that I work in, we focus not only on the sort of concrete issues like numbers of doctors and numbers of patients and various kinds of resources, but we also think in terms of how people respond to the environment that they're experiencing. So if someone is experiencing an environment, say, again, I'm using the emergency room as the problem child, because it often is the problem child, that in an emergency room, if people experience poor quality care or long waiting lines, then those have ripple effects throughout the entire system. And so in systems thinking, you're actually worrying about how people perceive the experience that they're having, whether they're whether it's the simply waiting time or it's something more like the art of medicine, which includes, do you have a relationship with your doctor? Do you feel connected to that doctor? If you don't feel connected to that doctor, perhaps because the doctor doesn't have enough time to spend with you or because you're always seeing a different doctor, then that can have these ripple effects that I'm describing. So that's really part of the art of medicine. But I mean, there are all sorts of maxims in the art of medicine that really have parallels in systems thinking. So for example, we all learned the maxim, you know, if you hear hoofbeats, don't think zebras, think horses, or what is going to kill this patient? Or, you know, there are various maxims that have been developed that are an effort to engage doctors in thinking more systemically, but they're not doing it in an organized fashion. It's just part of the ethos. But as the system gets more complicated, these maxims don't actually hold up anymore because, you know, you're no longer the only person taking care of this patient. For example, you're now, you know, part of this larger system. It might be you're part of a team and there are issues of integration of care. And so what you think makes sense from a personal perspective no longer works within the system that you're being forced to work in.
So as we reach system structure, how can system structure explain suboptimal performance? Can you give examples where failure to recognize the role of system structure leads to policy failure?
Well, I'll give you the example, which I think is probably the one of the most common problems, which is that, which is actually has a name in the field of system dynamics, which is actually one of the technical skill sets that one can use to do systems thinking. And it's the capability trap is starts with a recognition by someone, often somebody in a leadership position, that the emergency room is too crowded, say. And again, I'm using the emergency room as my example. The tendency then would be to change something within the emergency room. So the tendency would be to say, okay, we're going to change the number of staff that we have available. And so we change the number of staff available and we reduce that pressure on the emergency room. But those resources are coming from somewhere. And those resources may be coming from another part of the system. What happens, though, is if you were to say, okay, we're not going to hire new people, but what often happens is we're going to try to make the system more efficient, then everybody has to work harder. But we're not really dealing with the fundamental problem, which is that, for example, and I'll use one of my, you know, my favorite topics, which is that the primary care system is deteriorating. That as primary care is deteriorating, you're seeing more people coming into your emergency room. So this capability trap is that you start with trying to force the emergency room to be more efficient. And because you're not really you're not really dealing with the primary problem, that problem never goes away. In fact, it may actually even get worse. And the reason it gets worse is as you put pressure on the emergency room to push people through the emergency room so that you don't have too much, you don't have those long waiting lines, you end up with patients leaving the emergency room without their problem being managed. They go out into a primary care system that really isn't prepared to manage their problems in a more coherent way, and then they end up coming back to the emergency room. So that would be, I think, a reasonable example of the capability trap. But we have that in lots of situations. You know, I think the first place that people recognized it was in international development and health. So, for example, you know, you try to develop new forms of healthcare in low-income countries, but you don't actually create the infrastructure, the capability within the country to develop their own practitioners. And as a consequence, the clinics that you develop are functional for a while, but they don't really accomplish the task. And then eventually they have to fail. It's called sizzle and fizzle. You kind of put a lot of money into it. You don't actually deal with the primary problem. And then eventually the problem just gets worse and worse. And then people get disgusted with your solution and then take money away from you.
So how can an organization avoid this trap? Because it seems to me that some of it may be outside of the organization's abilities.
Well, first of all, one of the basic ideas of doing a systems thinking approach that's actually more than sentiment is to get all of these players, all of these stakeholders in the same room at the same time. Now, they're all going to have very different perspectives. They're all going to have different priorities. So if you have the administrative people, they are going to worry about the bottom line. If you have the emergency room doctors, they're all going to worry about how busy they are and whether they're burned out at the end of the day. And you're going to have the primary care doctors who have their own set of issues. But if you bring them into the room at the same time, you can go through a series of steps that allows people to, first of all, ask, what are we trying to accomplish as a group, as a whole? I mean, we all have some common set of goals. We then sit down and say, okay, well, what are the ones that are most important to you that are actually critical? And then you ask the question, what are the drivers of those outcomes that we care about? And then you look at where there might be these loops that might be reinforcing or balancing these kinds of loops that might actually be making the situation worse. And then once you identify those loops, you can say, well, what are our most promising leverage points that would allow us to break some of these vicious cycles? And that's really where the solutions lie, is trying to break the vicious cycles and to promote the virtuous cycles. But it's all it's recognition that much of what's going on, much of what the problem is that you're facing, is not that you have people who are malicious or who are, you know, who are too oriented towards money, although that may be true, but rather that nobody's looking at the whole problem at the same time. So you create what we call a common mental model. The challenge to doing that is that it takes time. And so doctors who are participating in this need to be able, need to have their time freed up and need to be willing to participate in this, because in my experience, that has been one of the barriers, is that, you know, you can get doctors in the room for an hour and then they have to run off and talk and then see their patients. So somehow the people, the powers that be, have to make this possible, have to make it possible to engage in this kind of activity. And I think that's really fundamental, is this is not something like it's a quick fix solution. It's something that requires people making a commitment of time and their conscious awareness. They have to be in the room at the time. Now, when systems thinking is well practiced, the people who facilitate systems thinking are really focusing on these issues constantly. They're focusing on keeping the people in the room attentive to what's going on and having them feel as though they are constantly making forward progress. So it's different than a lot of the kind of group activities that we're all engaged in, where we're told, oh, well, we have a problem in the emergency room. And there again, I go blaming the emergency room. But we have a problem. Let's come up with a list of what the causes of the problem are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, let's prioritize. And then let's hit the one that's priority 1 and 2. That's not systems thinking. That's just convenient. That's the most convenient form of group work that people tend to engage in, but it doesn't actually solve the systems level issues.
In recent years, we've seen a movement of private equity into healthcare. Does the presence of private equity impact what you're discussing and make it more difficult to get people together?
Well, that's a really complicated question, and it's very emotionally laden, obviously. I mean, as a physician, I talk to lots of physicians. I mean, I myself have not. I grew up in the old days, so and I work both in an environment where I never felt over pressured to see too many patients too fast. Okay, so doctors are now feeling that experience in spades. Private equity, where does that fit into this? I think that the problem, I would say, at a fundamental level with private equity is that private equity has an entirely different set of priorities than anyone else in the existing system. Private equity primarily is interested in profit. Nowhere else in this, when we talk about a healthcare system, especially when we're talking about the majority of healthcare systems in the US are not for profit. Their goal is to achieve health outcomes and not go into the red. That's a different story than saying, I want to be able to suck the blood out of this organization so that I can give myself a large annual bonus, and that I can look good in the marketplace so that my stock goes up. So that's a very different set of priorities. So as far as I'm concerned, private equity really has no special place in this environment, because it doesn't have, in general, it's not embedded in private equity, is not any one of the quadruple aim of healthcare, except for one, which is reducing per capita costs. They're not interested in health. I mean, to be honest, and it's not their fault, you know, they were built that way. Okay. They're not interested in cost. And the only they're interested in patient and provider satisfaction only insofar as it affects the bottom line. But fundamentally it's about profit. And the other thing is it's about short-term profits. So I gave you the example of the capability trap. The capability trap is a trap because we spend money in the short term, but we're not willing to stick it out in the long term and to solve the problem in the long term. So if you have an equity company who's worried about the next quarter or the next few quarters, then almost by definition, they are prone to experience the capability trap. Because it's very difficult for them to say, well, yes, it's good, I'm going to be spending, you know, $1 billion or $100 million or some gigantic amount of money in the next quarter or next few quarters. But in a year from now or 2 years from now, I'm going to start seeing some of the benefits from that investment. No, that's not good. That, as far as I can tell, that's not something that's in their DNA.
I would agree with you. Let's shift gears. Clinical guidelines and public health policy are produced all the time by professional societies and governmental agencies. What changes would be required for these groups to incorporate systems thinking in their work, and how can they manage the effort required to do so?
So that's another area that I worked in for maybe 20 years, which was working with medical professional societies, with government agencies, thinking about how do you choose amongst all these different options that are being made available to healthcare, and which ones should be promoted, which ones should be included in guidelines, how should they be included in guidelines. And that's all well and good. I mean, what we ended up with is, you know, what maximizes the, you know, what we used to say, or what we still say, the expected utility of the population. If we were to promote this new drug, would the world be a better place as measured by some, you know, by some metric? That's great. That's really important. But that's only a little piece of the story, because the larger piece of the story, and then we've gotten into cost effectiveness, is we've trans, at least in many places, the question is, not only is this thing going to make the world a better place, but is it worth the cost that we're going to have to invest in it? So I treat these as basically the same kind of issue, is, you know, is it worth it? Is it worth it in terms of the time that I have to invest in using the drug or using the test or whatever versus the benefit that's achieved? What really, when you start to think about it from a more systemic standpoint, you start to worry about these longer term issues, which are, what are going to be the secondary effects of incorporating this technology? So I'll give you the example in genetic testing. So there's some countries where genetic testing is just sort of freely available, and it's kind of Wild West. It's a crazy place. You know, you have some doctors using them, some doctors not using them, some doctors using them sensibly, some doctors using them stupidly. Well, okay, we can develop guidelines, but that's not stopping people from doing things that for other if because of other priorities, they may choose to use them. It may, for example, be that, you know, I say that I am the most up-to-date clinician in the building. I use precision medicine. Okay, So you get all these people who are using all these, you know, genetic tests and biomarkers and so on and so forth. So that's one extreme where basically you're taking absolutely nothing about the system into account, and you're only worrying about your own little silo, which is your clinic. You then have other situations where, say in the UK, where they've asked the question, well, is it cost effective to implement a genetic test? And if it is cost effective under some circumstance, it will be made available. And to the best of my understanding is that for the most part, if you are a clinician and you request a test that is on the list, and it's on the list because it's considered cost effective in some use case, you can get that test done. Now, in Singapore, we've taken a very different perspective. We've said, wait a second. We really have these are tests. There are thousands of these that could be implemented. Why don't we focus on the ones that actually are likely to make a big difference in the care of our population? And let's ask the question, not just is it cost effective, but what impact is it going to have on the healthcare system more broadly? So in fact, we're now sitting down and asking the question, who is going to do this? Where are they going to do this? Do we have the capability and capacity to do this? Are we going to overwhelm them? If we overwhelm them, what's going to be the secondary effect? So all of these issues are now being looked at from a systems thinking perspective. And indeed, we have a group that's now working on creating a simulation model of the implementation of genetic testing in Singapore for specific use cases. And then the idea is that one at a time, we're going to introduce these tests, but they're going to be introduced in the context of a workflow that makes sense in the whole system. We're not just throwing it out there and then just hoping that people know what to do. And so I think that would be an example of how, instead of just focusing on guidelines and cost effectiveness, which is really where we've been, and it's been fine, and I've done it for a living for a while, the next level is asking, does it really make sense in the broader context of the health system? And that's where we need to go.
It seems to me that it may make sense at a different time, that you're developing information and data sets that might be wildly beneficial down the road. What time horizon do you apply?
What time horizon do you apply for when you look at this as a systems level problem? Well, in general, there are very few things that have a what we call a net economic benefit, which is when you take both the health and the economic implications, that you're more negative than positive generally for at least 2 or 3 years. So I would say that you need to take a time horizon of around 5 years, if not more. But 5 years is about as long as you can get most administrative people thinking, because that is about the length of time before they end up changing jobs.
That's very interesting. You've mentioned that, as a rule, you're not a fan of team-based care as a strategy for dealing with the care of people whose complex problems require multiple health system players. It doesn't seem like a bad idea. What's the issue and what are the alternatives?
Well, the issue of team-based care, I don't think that team-based care is fundamentally bad. When I started in clinical practice, one of my jobs was overseeing what we call the hospital-based home care program. And we had a team of 5 people, but we were dealing with a series of complex patients, and they were identified as being complex because they had multiple health and social service needs that needed to be addressed simultaneously. So that in and of itself is not a bad thing. And in fact, I think in that case, we did a lot of good. What I'm getting at with some of the team-based care is when we talk about breaking patients down, say, into chronic kidney disease or heart failure, or, you know, breaking them down into their subcategories or diabetes, because people don't come that way. People come complicated, but they don't come with one disease. And even if they have one disease, their diabetes could be mild, or it could be they've got both legs amputated and they have serious vascular disease in their brain and heart and so on. So they have kidney disease. So the idea of breaking people into teams for those kinds of service needs is not really a great solution, because really what you're doing is just recreating the subspecialty system. But as one of my colleagues in Chicago, I think he's still in Chicago, is David Meltzer, says that once you create a team, you are multiplying the cost of every interaction manyfold. If you think about how expensive it is to have a team sitting in a room talking about a patient, and sometimes they're not even talking about the patient, they're basically just shooting the breeze. You know, they're talking about how interesting that person is, or something amusing about, you know, that happened that day. So you're wasting huge amounts of financial resources by bringing that team together, unless the team is really super duper focused and accomplishing something that they could not otherwise accomplish individually. So, I mean, that's part of the reason that I'm not a big fan of teams. The other reason is that I think that there's a phenomenon that we're seeing where it's coming from, in part, it's being encouraged by the artificial intelligence wave and the machine learning wave. And that is, there's now tons and tons of data that allow you to identify who are the expensive patients. There's tons and tons of data that tell you who are the patients who are likely to get readmitted to the hospital. It doesn't tell you what to do with them. It just tells you that they're going to be expensive, or it tells you that they're going to be complicated, but it doesn't tell you what to do. And so the question then becomes, and I've seen this repeatedly in applications for, I want to develop an artificial intelligence or machine learning algorithm for identifying X, Y, and Z. The question then becomes, well, what are you going to do about it? Well, of course, we're going to put them into a multidisciplinary care team. So basically what you've done is you've just kicked the can down the road. You haven't actually stopped and said, what have I learned about this person that's actionable? What you've said is, what I've learned about this person is that they're going to be a problem. But I don't know what the problem is, and I don't know what the best solution is. So I think that the idea of using team-based care as a way of kicking the can down the road is a mistake. I think that if we're going to do something about complex patients, we have to start asking, what are their health and social service needs, and what kind of construct can we create within the health system that will most efficiently address those needs? And so that's why I'm not a big fan of just the team. But I think teams in general are not a bad idea. I think that, you know, getting them to communicate. And I will say one last thing about teams, which is a bit of a problem. Depending on how the team is constructed, it may not be that there is an accountable individual within the team. Some teams, there is an accountable individual, and it usually would be the physician leader. So you have a physician who's overseeing the team, and then all information flows through that provider, through that physician, so that they ultimately are responsible for helping coordinate the activity of the team. But what I have seen is that there are teams where there may be more than one doctor. There may be a doctor, a primary care doctor, and a specialist, or more than one specialist. And the responsibility is not obvious. And so when there is no individual who is responsible, it's a truism, but when no specific person is responsible, then nobody's responsible. And I think the one thing that we have lost to a large extent in healthcare is a sense of accountability. And so teams actually have the run the risk. I'm not saying they will, but they run the risk of diffusing accountability. And by diffusing accountability, you reduce the ultimate effectiveness and you increase the risk.
As our time together grows to an end, it seems to me you've made strong arguments and you've convinced me of the benefit of systems thinking. Someone in our audience today, Doctor, wanted to learn how to apply systems thinking in healthcare management in a way that is, as you say, more than just sentimental. Where would you direct that person?
For someone who has the inclination, there are master's programs, there are advanced programs that you can go to. Most doctors will not have the time, even if they have a background in statistics or mathematics or engineering, they may not have the time. Although I'm increasingly discovering people who are going into medicine, coming out of engineering, for whom this is absolutely natural. And all they really need is a little bit of extra, a few days or a week or a couple of weeks of coursework before they can start applying this. In most situations where you don't have somebody like that, they don't have the time or they don't have the inclination, there are several methodologies that are out there for which you can engage consultants to help you with this process. It can help you plan. If you're saying, we really have, and I'm going to go back to the emergency room, we're really having a problem with our emergency room. Can you help us develop a common representations that we can all understand and that we can identify where our potential leverage points are and help us move forward to get us out of this hole? Those people are available. Now, it comes under different rubrics. The most common one the group that I work with are people in system dynamics, but there are other methodologies. There's something called the theory of constraints, which has its own set of practitioners. There's something called viable systems modeling, which is more of a top-down qualitative approach that basically treats the healthcare system as an organism and uses specific methods. But all of them, what they have in common is that they are systematic, that they are progressive in the sense that you start with the end in mind and the goal of the exercise is to identify your leverage points. So what I would say to answer your question is that it would be useful to tap into some of these people who are available. There may not be enough of them out there to solve all the problems that we're facing or that physician leaders are facing, but they're available. And I think that that once you start to do it once or twice or three times, often you can start to really intuit how to do it yourself.
Interesting. My guest has been Dr. David Machar. Dr. Machar, thank you so much for being on Sound Practice.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My thanks to Dr. David Machar. His work is making healthcare better for patients and providers. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpracticepodcast.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpracticepodcast.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. Holy cow, that man.
Robin, Ritwin Kapow.